Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy at the Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of the ascetical homilies of St. Isaac the Syrian. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
Help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writers series. And we're picking up again with our reading of St. Isaac the Syrian's ascetical homilies. And we're currently reading the fifth homily on keeping oneself remote from the world and from all things that disquiet the mind. And so we began last week, and we're on page 156 at the very bottom of the page. And so within this homily, Isaac is trying to help us avoid all the things that would place us in the grip of the passions. So avoid all the things within the world. Make yourself remote from the things that would give rise to the passions. The world in the sense of not, you know, the world around us so much, but as the things that give rise to the passions and sins within us. And then also to avoid anything that causes disquiet within the mind. So anything that would disturb us within and make it very difficult for us to pray, or distracts us that we don't see the approach of the demons that would seek to afflict us. And we've been looking here at the end of last week on fighting on the right battlefield. So if we're struggling with a particular sin, say against chastity, that's where we would fight the battle, that we wouldn't be focusing on giving alms or some other spiritual practice, that we would be focusing on the things that lead us into that sin, and that we would be, and this is what we'll be looking at tonight, using also the right remedies. So not only fighting on the right battlefield, but making use of the remedies that the Fathers give to us. So if it is with a lack of chastity, we would be making use of fasting in particular, that we would seek to strengthen one appetite, strengthen our control, the control of the will over one appetite, so that we might gain strength of will over another bodily appetite. And this is where Isaac is going to pick up this evening. And so we're at the very bottom of 156 with the words Saint Ephrem. St. Ephrem said, "In summertime, do not struggle against the scorching heat in winter clothing. Let each man reap by means that oppose the iniquity he has sown. Every disease is cured with its own remedies, and you, who are overcome by envy, why do you battle against sleep? While the transgression is still small and blossoming, pluck it up before it spreads and covers the field. Do not be negligent when your faults seem slight to you, for later you will find it in an inhuman master, and will be running before it like a shackled slave. But a man who fights against a passion from the start will soon subdue it." So don't engage in a struggle in the scorching heat with winter clothing, that we don't want to come into the battle where we're going to be overcome and burdened down by what we've clothed ourselves with, that it wouldn't be appropriate for us to wear winter garments in the summer, and so it wouldn't be appropriate for us to, you know, put on certain practices when we are engaging in a particular battle, that say maybe we need to run light, and so we don't burden ourselves down with a lot of material goods, that we would want to simplify our lives and strip ourselves from those things in order that we might not be weighed down in the battle, as it were, and so fatigue ourselves. Let each man reap by means that oppose the iniquity he has sown. So again, that we make use of the remedies that are necessary to overcome the particular sins that we've sown or allowed to be sown within us. Every disease is cured with its own remedies. And don't become negligent when your fault is slight. This stood out to me in particular, that I think there is a tendency among us today to look at certain sins as being slight, and so not worthy of our attention in the spiritual life. That so long as we live a life that avoids the more serious sins, that even if we are engaging regularly in what often is called, what are often called venial sins, that all is fine, that we don't have to worry about that. But the wisdom of the tradition tells us that there are no slight sins, that every sin can become a deadly sin, every sin can become a mortal sin. So even when we look at the capital sins, in and of themselves, they're not mortal. Lust, gluttony, avarice, that, you know, in and of themselves, they might manifest themselves in smaller ways. Lust could be simply with, an adulterous glance or something like that, or maybe allowing ourselves to listen to certain music or watch certain television programs to sort of push the envelope. And we might think those things to be slight, but the more that we expose our hearts to them, the more our consciences become coarsened, and then gradually we allow ourselves to be exposed to more and more things that would then perhaps lead us into greater sins. And this can be true of relationships too, that things that are rather innocent can develop into things that become more problematic and sinful over time. And so we really have to break this habit of thinking of somehow certain sins are less important and don't require our attention. That if the devil is going to tempt us, a good way to do it would be to present us with all things that we see of no consequence. That this would be a way of roping us in, that I've really never struggled with this, or it's no big deal, or everybody seems to engage in it, even religious people I know, or priests, or nuns, it's not an issue, obviously. And it's by this means then that we can be drawn in to the things that we would really want to be avoiding altogether if we are seeking to live a life of virtue, but also the life of deep prayer that Isaac is putting forward here before us. That to expose ourselves to even things that are distracting, that easily then become idols for us, that we give more attention to them than we give to God. And so in some sense, they can even become the more serious of sins for us. We get hooked on certain television series, and so we will watch them, incessantly, sacrificing our prayer time. And so it becomes a kind of idol for us, or we let go of certain aspects of our prayer because of the poor use of that time. And on the surface, again, it seems innocent to us, or everyone's talking about it within the culture, and so we think, okay, I don't have to worry about this. Okay. But eventually he says, if we do see them as slight, then we will be running before it like a shackled slave. So eventually what we saw as nothing or slight, something that we felt that we had control over, eventually becomes something that controls us, and that we become enslaved to it. It's driving us in life, or leading us where it wants us to go, rather than the opposite.
It's quite an image, running behind something like a shackled slave.
Yeah. Or we become the shackled slave. Oh, running before it like a shackled slave.
We're
being driven as by the
okay.
whip before it's even stronger. Right.
You just see the image going through the desert, no water around, and you're just a shackled slave
right.
to this monster of a thing.
Yeah. And so you can see how we've lost a sense of this. Like even the capital sins, or what have often been called the deadly sins, caput means head. So they are the sins that lead to all the far more grave sins. So again, they aren't necessarily mortal in and of themselves, but they lead to what is mortal. So we have to be attentive to these things and rip them up by the root as we see them small before they get large and take over our entire lives. While the transgression is still small and blossoming, pluck it up before it spreads and covers the entire field. So it doesn't take very long for our lives to be taken over by something that causes us great grief in the future. Out at Red Noir Farm in Ligonier, we have something called multifloral rose. And it's sort of like a ground cover that's, you know, in Pennsylvania, sort of, you know, takes over. But it in the end, it has like these 3-inch jaggers on it, and it kills everything around it, and you can't get through it. So it takes over, can take over whole territories of property. And so this is true for us in the spiritual life too. What seems to be a little nothing plant can grow into something that really, with little spikes growing out of it that scourge, you know, will scourge us over time or become a scourge to us.
And kill everything else around it.
Right.
Even the good things that have blossomed, you know.
Right, it prevents the growth of that which is good.
Just like a sinner pulling others into that sin as well, not just that one person. The people around can actually be contaminated with the sins of others.
Yeah, I think that's true. Maybe, even if he isn't talking about that here, I think certainly throughout the writings of the Father, they warn us not to expose ourselves to company that would lead us into sin, which has become a very unpopular notion again these days. It's like we should have a kind of freedom to mix with whoever we want. And this doesn't fit certainly with the wisdom, you know, of the fathers, or even in a sense the gospels, that, you know, we can be affected by the behaviors of others. And as we go through the text here again and again, we're warned not to think ourselves stronger than what we are. And so to immerse ourselves not only in certain behaviors, but in certain relationships indiscriminately is a bad thing. Like, discrimination is a key element in the spiritual life. We need to learn how to discriminate, not in the sense that we, you know, look down on other people, but we have to learn how to discriminate between that which is good and evil. And when we lose that ability or are unwilling to make use of that ability, you know, out of a false sense of charity, then we place ourselves in danger. And I think even now, we were talking about this at dinner, about kind of evangelization, you know, engaging in the culture, and how would a student, you know, approach this. And, you know, there are certain things that, you know, in the West, we've always seen the church is engaging the culture. But by that, we mean the arts and sciences and things like that we would bring, you know, all that is good and holy and transform that and build it up in whatever way that we could. And we've seen how the church has done that throughout the centuries, especially, say, with art. The church has been a great support to the arts over the generations. But it doesn't mean that we immerse ourselves in the drunken culture of university life, you know, where you're hanging out at the bars or engaging in all the activities that would pull you away from your faith. That there has to be a culture within which you exist that helps form and develop that faith, and that enables you then to engage the university culture, the good aspects of it, you know, that where you're forming the mind and the intellect, the reason, and developing a greater sense of history and love of the arts, not to engage in what has become an adolescent culture, perpetual adolescent culture of university life. And so we have to be, you know, again, very careful and discriminating about that. The next paragraph, he goes on to say, he who is able to suffer a wrong with joy, though having means at hand to rebuff it, has consciously received from God the consolation of his faith. The man who endures accusations against himself with humility has arrived at perfection, and he is marveled at by the holy angels, for there is no other virtue so great and so hard to achieve. And so to be able to suffer wrong, you know, to be able to have the kind of humility that allows us to endure accusations that are false, that there's detraction or where there's calumny, I'm sorry, or slander, that we would be able to endure those things in the same spirit as Christ. And when we look at not only the life of Christ, but also of the saints, we see this happen again and again. They are tested in regards to their own sense of dignity very often, that they are cast down in the eyes of others, diminished in their eyes. And how they endure that shows the perfection of their faith. So even Philip Neri, you know, while loved by so many in Rome during his time, the fruit of his labors all often became a source of envy and jealousy. And there was a time where, you know, he had to cease all practice of oratory, exercises at the oratory, and wasn't really able to function so much as a priest until the trial was over. But he endured it by simply, you know, obeying the commands of superiors and letting go of the things that he knew were bearing fruit. But there was a greater fruit to be had through his humility and his obedience, even in the face of his detractors. And this is a hard thing, because we often want to rise to our own defense when we feel that somebody is treating us poorly, especially when we feel that we're in the right, that they are tearing down, you know, our identity in the eyes of others. And so often we will avoid that possibility as much as we can too, by not, you know, perhaps placing ourselves in the path of others. There can be a kind of cowardice about that too. So it's not only humility, but I think there's a kind of courage involved in this virtue of being able to remain quiet in the face of it and endure it. So any comments, or I thought I heard a little gasp of air that might have all right, the next paragraph.
No, I was just thinking how difficult that was.
How difficult?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
That's a tough
and
one.
You know, I think that's true pretty much for a lot of priests today, simply by being a priest. I think because of the recent scandals within the life of the church, that, you know, often to embrace a celibate lifestyle and, you know, to be associated with this ministry is to be seen as somehow abnormal and not to be trusted. And I've had good Catholics come up and say, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, whenever I see a priest up on the altar, the first thought that comes to my mind is pedophile.
Oh,
and, you know, it's there's not a viciousness there, but it so permeated the media at that point that for years, I would say that I had people that were filled with anger because they felt betrayed by the church because of all of this, and rightly so. And priests, most of all, were angered by it, but had often to listen to and counsel those who felt that the church had failed in this enormous way. So to endure that, and endure that silently, and not to get into this position of constantly defending, certainly not defending the indefensible, but not even defending, you know, the dignity of the priesthood, in the face of the loss of that dignity because of what others had done. And in some sense that is still true within the life of the church, and not to hide that identity in the face of that reality. I think the temptation now would be to hide one's identity as a priest and, you know, not wear clerics and things such as that when you're out and about, for, you know, fear of how people would look at you or treat you. And
Or even the thoughts that you might think they have in their mind, quite silently, without any glance, no words, no nothing, just in terms of...
Yeah, not giving yourself over to that,
mm-hmm.
and not so much caring about that. I mean, I think there is a sense that we have to be detached from that, any sense of personal dignity. And when we follow a crucified Lord, who is crucified as a criminal, a blasphemer, you know, an enemy of God, you know, that we have to sort of be willing to be detached from, you know, our sense of identity in the eyes of others as being good.
How much of that detachment can be practiced, and how much is a gift of grace? And I guess maybe that would depend on which Desert Father you're asking as well, but...
Well, I think it all is a gift of grace. You know, I think it's only by grace that one could do that. But I think it's, you know, over time that one keeps before one's eyes Christ, in Christ crucified. And you practice by first remaining silent, you know, by keeping your mouth shut in the face of, you know, those critiques that others might offer. And you know, that could be a very, again, a very difficult thing, because I think our tendency is to want to defend the self, defend the ego, and so to put on Christ, put on the mind of Christ, means not to be concerned about that. What we are to be concerned about is the will of God, and fulfilling that will, whatever the cost might be. There was another thought that I had in mind, but maybe it'll come to me, but I sort of lost it.
Okay. I imagine that might be even more difficult. I think until now you've spoken about sort of the world, the public, but when it's a friend,
mm-hmm.
or maybe, you know, and people in your surrounding, whatever your circles of friendship are, that could to stay silent in those circumstances could be even more difficult sometimes.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Do not believe yourself to be strong until you are tempted and find yourself superior to change. So, you know, we can never see ourselves as being strong until we've undergone certain tests and haven't given ourselves over to them and so been moved. And so, you know, don't consider yourself strong until you are superior to change, until you remain unmoved by the test and your heart remains unmoved. So the ability to not be fazed by and there are all these stories among the Desert Fathers, you know, about someone within a community just rebuking someone in front of the whole crowd of the monastery, and the person bearing it very well and not saying a word. And again, that's hard for us to imagine, but it bears witness to what he's talking about here, that the heart had been so formed in this man by a spirit of obedience and humility that he could receive those things and not be stirred at all. And, you know, I think there's this sense in us that we fear that we'll become doormats, or that we'll just be, you know, we're opening ourselves up to abuse, the abuse of others. And there's a difference between someone who's obviously in an abusive relationship, or a toxic relationship where, you know, it's not healthy spiritually or emotionally or physically, you know, at times. and someone who's seeking to imitate Christ, and you know, is not clinging to a kind of identity, they're a false identity. You know, that somehow we deserve more than he deserved. And you know, to live the gospel in, you know, this goes against the grain, and I think it's an affront to our sensitivities and sensibilities that, you know, we will experience the hatred of the world, Christ tells us, as he experienced it. And so to be victims of injustice, or to be, you know, victims as he was a victim, you know, to be slandered and calumnized and maltreated, you know, it's part of what following him means. And if we fight against that and reject it, then how is it that we are walking along the path of the cross? We have to be prepared for that. And we have to count the cost and understand what it is that we are embracing before we do it. Yes?
Should we also sit idle when it comes to our faith and defending Christ, though, at the same time, if, you know, where do you draw the line when it comes to speaking up about maybe defending Catholicism, mm-hmm. our belief system?
Yeah. You know, often defending Catholicism is more about defending, you know, it's more about our pride, you know, that there's something that activates within us that we feel, okay, this is something I believe in and hold dear, and so I have to rise up and engage in a verbal battle with someone about the faith. And I think there's a temptation in that, that even Cardinal Newman, who was this brilliant theologian, philosopher, you know, that he said, you know, to try to argue someone into the faith is a kind of, there's a kind of insanity about that, that you can't force them into faith any more than you could force someone to, I don't know.
Right, but not trying to force someone into
species,
the faith,
huh?
But if someone were to ridicule the faith, or, you know, I feel a need to defend Christ in a way, right?
Yeah. What we have to ask ourselves is, does Christ need defending? And how do we defend Christ? Mm-hmm. Do we defend him more by the way that we live our lives and by the long suffering that others would witness in us, even while they hold us in contempt? You know, if we're going to defend the faith at every turn, then we're going to be fighting constantly, and we're going to fall into the disquiet that Isaac talks about here, that we will know peace in our lives if we do that. You know, I walked down to the corner store with my mom this afternoon, and I was wearing a black coat, and I had a black sweater on, zipped up, but I didn't have my collar on because we were just going for a walk, but I zipped up. But obviously, I still looked like a priest. And there was a guy looking me up and down, and he walked back.
It's a beard.
That's right. And he walked back and forth, eyeballing me. You know, he was looking me up and down and wondering, is this guy a clergyman, a priest? And I recognized him from way back. And he's one of those street preachers. And he was a baby. He started in the store baiting me about, you know, sin. You know, I'm a sinner. And, you know, he was trying to say that all is grace, but then there's no free will, so I might as well continue to sin. And so I think, knowing that I was a priest, he was trying to bait me into a discussion about confession and about asceticism, too. You know, whether or not there's any value to our freely engaging in the ascetic life. And, you know, I engaged him on a certain level. You know, no, I agree, all is grace. But, you know, there is no love without freedom. And, you know, he just sort of wandered off after a minute or so. But, you know, I think we could allow ourselves to lose our peace in that and get caught up in sort of this absurd discussion that really bears no fruit. Or I could have gotten angry at him and, you know, just shoot him away. And it wouldn't have borne fruit either.
Yeah, but then there are other, I'm thinking what comes to mind is, do you remember that video, it's on YouTube, of Mother Angelica? It was the after the Denver, the Denver Youth World Youth Day, when Jesus was portrayed, a woman portrayed Jesus as a pantomime, and that's the day she went that's the day she went off and went back to the old habit, and you know, she telling people, I don't like your religion, you know, speaking to sort of what she perceived as the liberal establishment that was, you know, organizing this to take. But there, she was, I think in part the anger was perhaps coming from the destruction that was of the faith of simple people, the elderly, children, who, so it seems though there is a time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I certainly don't want to speak to what was within Mother Angelica's heart, nor speak about the dead.
Yes.
In a negative way. But, you know, I think even those who are saintly, you know, that there are aspects of their character, the things are filtered through their character and they still act upon them, and there can be this mix of holiness and an unredeemed aspects of their character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, there can be an I think a lot of people would say, well, that was a holy anger, or righteous anger, and that she gave vent to, and that there was something there that was, you know, spirit-driven. But, you know, I think we have to be cautious about that, that even among saintly figures, that within this life, you know, we're on this journey and where there's a kind of purification, and a kind of purification that only takes place through affliction. And so there can be this love of things that are holy. And, you know, the fathers talk about our defense of that within us is the incensive faculty, where we become incensed. And so we rise up and fight the passionate thoughts, the temptations that come to us. But that incensive faculty can be directed to things outward. Isaac is even going to discuss that here later on, that it can be directed outward in ways that it is focused on others and their flaws and their weaknesses. And so that anger can spill over into the correcting of others. And I think we have to be, you know, so again, I can't speak to that situation, but I think we have to be very careful about that, of not immediately, because it's focused on something, the critique is accurate, then to make the critique and the tone of the critique into something that is virtuous and good. You know, I think, you know, for, you know, meekness is important, especially in those moments when there is an anger there over an injustice or something that is gravely sinful. And if that anger isn't shaped and transformed by love, then it can become acerbic, and it can, you know, things can come out and sounding like mockery of others, and, you know, a harshness that is biting, you know. And so I think that isn't reflective of the love of God that is, you know, constantly seeking us out and that endures things like that at every moment from us. Yeah. So again, I think we have to be careful.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think, too, that most often when people say something that would, I don't know, call forth that desire to defend, that most of the time their motivation really is to bait the individual. Like, how many people who say something negative about the church or Christ actually have a beef, you know, in that particular, like, they're not trying to insult him. They're trying to insult us, you know, and bait us. And, like, I'm thinking of, you know, and in his own lifetime, Christ stood completely silent through the whole passion. But you brought up Philip Neri, and I remember he kind of had the same thing going on, where it was his spiritual children in their like places of work or whatever, people would try to like, you know, undermine or ridicule it. They would be like, oh, have you gone off to Master Phillips to get your cake yet today? And like, you know, they would say these like little petty biting, like trying to undermine all of that. And, you know, I think they pretty much just walked away and then went to see Philip that day, you know, like, but, you know, were they really trying to, I mean, it might have been something in Philip that caused that, but clearly they were trying to bait those people too.
And, you know, I think what Isaac is calling us to reflect upon is the peace of the kingdom and the peace that we are to maintain within, that we are often stirred to anger, frustration, distraction, because we are not living in that peace, that we are, you know, driven by our passions or driven by our emotions to such an extent that we lose that connection with God. And then we are often driven to say things that we wouldn't otherwise say or that really wouldn't really be reflective of the peace, again, of the kingdom. You know, a worldly peace that we might say then, well, we have to fight for that, or, you know, but that's not, we're called to something far more, to participate in a divine.
But Father, what about if there is not anger along with that? We can be defensive of our faith without being angry. We can profess our Catholicism without being angry. I mean, what did Christ mean then when he said, if you are ashamed of me on earth, I will be ashamed of you then?
That's right. You're right. We can talk about our faith,
peaceful,
and if somebody,
okay,
you know, questions it, we can seek to articulate it the best we can, but it doesn't mean that we have to lash out at others. And I think this is the danger if the heart hasn't been formed in the way that Isaac is telling us. So, okay, do not believe yourself to be strong until you are tempted and find yourself superior to change. In this manner, test yourself in everything. Acquire a right faith in yourself so that you may trample down your enemies. Keep your mind lowly and place no confidence in your strength, lest you be given over to the frailty of your nature. And then from your own fall, you will learn your own weakness. Nor should you trust your knowledge, lest you be found amid subtle snares and you become entangled. Have a meek tongue, and dishonor will never encounter you. Acquire sweet lips, and you will have all men as your friends. Never boast of your labors with your tongue, lest you be put to shame. In each matter about which a man boasts himself, God permits that he change, so that he should be humbled and learn humility. This is why you must surrender all things to God's foreknowledge and not believe that there is anything in this life unchanging. So, you know, we are then to have this meek tongue and sweet lips, that we are to seek to win over by love, by charity, not by argument. And again, this is something that a lot of people would disagree with. I mean, you get on the internet, you know, the way that the faith is talked about is often in the context of issues and argument, rather than, you know, focusing upon how it is that we form our hearts in light of the gospel. And we are to have sweet lips, you know, again, with, you know, gentle in our speech towards others. And, you know, God will allow us to experience the changeability within our own hearts. You know, we can become changeable souls, you know, that we are driven here and there when the moment that we believe that we have a superior knowledge about something or that we're above a particular sin. It's at that moment that he's going to allow us to see how frail we really are. And so we have to have a true knowledge in ourselves and a confident knowledge in ourselves. And that confidence should be rooted in our own need for God. That's really the own rock of our stability.
About.
Yeah, God is the eternal rock. We stand on Him, and that's the stability and the, where the confidence comes from. It doesn't come from ourselves. I think if we're all honest, we would know ourselves as being, you know, reeds blown in the wind, you know, tossed here and there, unless we're rooted in that relationship with God. Acting in this manner, your eye will be always lifted to God. For God's protection and providence encircle all men, yet they are not seen except by those who have cleansed themselves from sin and continually keep their attention on God and on Him alone. But God's providence is especially apparent to them when they enter into a great trial on behalf of the truth. For then they perceive it as if seeing it with their bodily eyes. Each man in proportion to the magnitude of the temptation which befalls him and according to the cause thereof. This is the case in order that providence might anoint its champions to have courage in this manner, as with Jacob and Jesus of Navi, who I think they're speaking of Joshua there, and the three children, I think those are the three thrown in the furnace, and then Peter, and the rest of the saints to whom it appeared in a human form, giving them confidence and confirming them in godliness. So they saw the providence of God in a very concrete way by the presence of His angels. And Isaac is going to get into a whole description here about how they give us fortitude, how they instruct us, how they guide us in our perplexity. And that for those who really live this life where they trust in the providence of God, that presence of God becomes very concrete for them. That after going through these deep trials and affliction, their faith in God is perfected. That as they see themselves having been drawn through and experiencing great crosses and yet coming out the other side, and they see the wisdom of God and the fruit that was born from that, then that virtue is perfected. So every time then, as they go through a trial, they can see the providence of God in it immediately. He says, as with bodily eyes. So they begin to see that presence in very concrete ways. And how it's manifested to us often in the scriptures and in the lives of the saints is that they see the presence of angels. And, you know, Christ Himself speaks of the angels, always being before the throne of God, interceding on behalf of the lowly ones, so that we are not to mistreat the poor and the lowly ones of the world, and we are to become poor and lowly ourselves, and the more that we become so, the more we begin to experience the presence and protection and the prayers of our guardian angels. And this is what Isaac is going to talk about here shortly.
That's a really cool way to talk about angels, as like the embodiment of the protection and providence of God,
right,
that exists as spirit, as He does, insofar as they're an emanation of Him, but a man with perfected sight, because human sight is always going to have a bodily element, now see angels in a human, in a form.
Right.
So cool.
I think it's beautiful, because I think in most cases, I think Christians think of angels as sort of mythical characters, you know, that would show up in a movie or in a Tolkien book, you know, but not as, you know, those who have an effect upon our lives and protect us and guide us and strengthen us and come to our aid as they came to the aid of Christ Himself in the Garden of Gethsemane to sort of support Him for the coming trial. And so if we reduce them to these mythical creatures, then I think it really reflects our lack of faith and our lack of trust in that providence. The more perfect that trust is, and the more perfect that faith is, the greater the vision is going to be. The, yes, I believe this, I see this in and through with the eyes of faith. I can see the providence of God in all these experiences in my life.
Which is why it becomes possible to, as he said a few homilies ago, to banish your guardian angel, because if you willingly step outside of the realm of God's will for you, you banish his protection and providence from your life. So, like, it's not like he has all these plans and then your mean angel is like, oh, well, you screwed up, I'm leaving. You know, it's more like, I am the protection and providence of God for your life, and if you choose to not live within that, I can't then, be present to you.
Right, then you will not experience it. And I think it's the reason for our anxiety, too, that, you know, anxiety is this ubiquitous reality. Everyone experiences it. And the root and the cause of that sin, of that anxiety is sin. You know, this experience of our being separated from God. And, you know, whenever we embrace and live in that sin, then the deeper that existential anxiety becomes for us. But the more we move away from the sin and move into the life of God, the more we experience his providence, his protection, and then we can be free of anxiety and fear altogether. That there would be nothing in this world that would frighten us. But those who lack it fear their own shadow. And so he goes on to discuss this, and so we have a little bit of time here, so let's let him unpack it for us here. He says, but if you say that these things were granted to the saints from God by way of economy, and that it was for special reasons that they were deemed worthy of such visions, then let the holy martyrs be examples to encourage you. So there is this tendency that, okay, well, they were the special ones who were given this vision of angels. And so even if we don't see them as mythical creatures, we relegate them out to the margins, that they are only there for the most saintly and rare souls rather than for us all. And so he says, look to the martyrs. The martyrs often, many together, but sometimes one alone, in places both many and diverse, contested for Christ's sake, and with the secret strength that came to them, they courageously endured in bodies of clay the lacerations of iron and torments of every kind, things that surpass nature. But also to such as these, the holy angels would manifestly appear, so that every man might learn that divine providence is very near to those who in every manner endure both every temptation and every affliction for the Lord's sake, for their encouragement and for the shaming of their enemies. For inasmuch as the saints were roused to manliness by visions of this kind, to just such a degree did their adversaries rage and become frenzied with wrath at their unyielding patience. And so in the martyrs, you often see them rise up to this great kind of courage, as if being strengthened, fortified by something greater than themselves, a strength greater than themselves. And the more strong they become in the face of that affliction and torment, the more their enemies rage against them because they can't move them away from their faith. And so you find certain martyrs, you know, laughing about their torture or embracing it with a kind of joyfulness, or while singing hymns, or, you know, while being meek or weak, you know, going up the scaffold, you know, to have their head chopped off, you know. And all of these things are evidence, Isaac is telling us, of the presence of angels and the presence of God's providence. But also, let's see, where did I leave off here?
But what need
is there to speak of the ascetics, those strangers to the world, and of the anchorites who made the desert a city and a dwelling place and a hostelry of angels? So, you know, what do we say of, you know, what need would there be for ascetics, you know, for such things? Or what can we possibly say about them in regards to this providence? And he says, for the angels continually visited these men because their modes of life were so similar, and as being troops of a single sovereign, and at all times they kept company with their comrades in arms, that is to say, those who embraced the desert all the days of their life, took up their abode in mountains and in dens and in caves of the earth because of their love for God. And since having abandoned things earthly, they loved the heavenly and were become imitators of the angels. Rightly did those very same holy angels not conceal the sight of themselves from them, and they fulfilled their every wish. So even though they were engaged in a far different kind of battle, that theirs wasn't a bloody martyrdom, but rather a white martyrdom, that they go there to die to self, and they go there also to do battle with the demons, that they too were subject to and the support of these angels in that battle, that they would be encouraged in the ascetic hardships that they would embrace. All of this strikes me as very important. You know, we live in a generation where maybe we do lack a kind of courage and zeal in the spiritual life, both in, you know, how we pray, the discipline that we embrace, our willingness to sacrifice and give certain things up. And so to know that there is a kind of providence that will be with us in that, and that it is so immediate and tangible, can be so immediate and tangible for us, that the deeper our faith becomes, the more that we engage in these spiritual realities and the spiritual battle, the more that we're going to experience that support and presence. And so all of this is meant to spur us on, to encourage us to take this path, not to be fearful, that we are going to be on that battlefield, not alone, but with a host of angels that are fighting with us and that are going to encourage and strengthen us, whatever that battlefield might be. And he goes on to lay them out. You know, sometimes for us it will be illness, dealing with, you know, the reality of our own corrupt nature, and to be able to bear that reality with kind of faith and hope in God. Or perhaps it will be in the face of temptations or the rejection of the world, but in whatever state, that we will know that support, and so we need not have any fear at all. Any comments so far about this?
Well, I've always thought it was really interesting that in most of this, in almost every story of the martyrs, if they weren't the ones who were speaking, in so far as they were saying something, you know, that just like Lawrence or something, you know, one of their like across the board characteristics is complete silence. And it was actually one of the things that always made me like kind of intimidated, you know. I'd be like, I just don't, there's nothing I can anticipate of my own strength that I would say, oh yeah, I think I could like find the strength to stand, you know, being burnt at the stake and just stand there real quiet and wait to die. Like, it was always so amazing to me that no matter, I mean, there were saints, there were martyrs that were boiled in oil. Like, that's how they died. It's always the one I didn't want.
And that image of Bartholomew where he's, it looks like he has a cloak over his shoulder, and it's really, have you ever seen the statue?
Yeah, I think so.
And it looks like a cloak at first, but then you look down and there's like the image of a hand, so it's really a skin because they had flayed him.
Or the
alive.
Men that were put on the ice, and they just like slowly froze to death. It was just amazing.
But the reality is that we can barely bear with any irritation in our day-to-day life.
Yeah.
Which makes that sort of funny, thinking that, you know, that we could, maybe if it was just quick, as they cut off my head, I'll be able to
guns
endure that.
I
think most of us would probably be.
I think we have the idea that just being beheaded would probably hurt a lot less than a paper cut that bothers us all day.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
We're, you know, we can't be assured in that. You know, it's, you know, that somehow, you know, without living the life of faith and without giving ourselves over to God completely and being so immersed in His grace that we would be able to endure that just because it would be quick. You know, there's a movie that's come out recently called Silence, you know, about the missionaries, Jesuit missionaries in Japan. Yeah. And in the face of that, they fold. You know, at least how it's presented in the movie, that you know, when they're faced not only with their own martyrdom, but the martyrdom of the ones that they had won over to Christianity, that they, you know, a number of them apostatized, that, you know, and end up, you know, denying the faith in order to save their own skin. And the reason for these two missionaries going off to Japan was to find a Jesuit who was their great teacher and who had the greatest courage of all of them. And the rumor, the last rumor to get back to, I think it was Portugal, was that he had left the faith. And so they go off in search of him, thinking that it couldn't possibly be true. And, you know, in reality, you know, he places his foot on, you know, an image of Christ crucified, and, you know, he takes up, you know, he becomes a teacher in their culture and takes a wife, and, you know, all to, you know, avoid this. So, you know, it is only this kind of, not only the radical humility, but this constancy in living in Christ that would give us the strength to live that out. You know, there's no sense of being able to embrace either the martyrdom of the desert or the martyrdom of some torture outside of Christ. It's only by divine strength, by divine grace, that we are able to endure such things. Yeah. And so we have to sort of set it out of our mind that somehow, you know, that it would be an easy thing for us to endure.
Yeah, and to think that people are going through that today. You know, it's not like we don't have to, we have the martyrs of the past, but there are people in the Middle East who are being put in cages and burned alive. Yeah. And
but we're sanitizing it. I mean, we don't look at it, and we don't look at the images, and, you know, certainly the media has downplayed it. You know, you hear nothing of, like, the Christians in Iraq who were, you know, where the church, Christianity has pretty much been driven out, and other countries in the Middle East where that is taking place too.
Yeah, I know someone who was just there and was able to get, just in the past week, and was able to get 9 miles from Mosul to one of the towns where there had been 10,000 Christians living there, and now it's empty.
Right.
And this person said, this is a quote, it was like the wrath, they went through it, and it was like the wrath of Satan had been through that town. It was so, such a spirit of, you know, desolation beyond the destruction.
Right.
Yeah, there were a bunch of pictures released of, like, the Nineveh plain recently, and just showing, like, the complete, and it was showing, it was really interesting, because there were lots of before pictures, too, and then, and after, and it was just, I mean, it was... It was unbelievable, honestly.
Yeah. It's almost as if the Christians of the West don't care. Because, like, all the studies are showing that, you know, the religious group that is most persecuted throughout the world is, you know, Christianity. Christians.
It brings to mind, during all this political upset, there was some talking head that was saying, talking about Christian persecution, and the opponent said, well, there's persecution everywhere, forget the Christian persecution. And the gentleman persisted and said, no, this is prevalent, it is out of control around the world. And the other guy just kept trying to cover up. He said, no, it's not just Christians, and so it's so buffered.
Right.
But in the West here, when we look at this horrific suffering that we can't even comprehend, does it make us, we have our little daily sufferings, or many, you know, maybe major sufferings, and is that is also a path to martyrdom as well, if you have a life, if one has a lifetime as a Christian of sufferings, and that Christian's faith still remains very strong?
No.
That is not a form of martyrdom, no.
I don't want to be flippant about it, but
we're never going to experience that beheading.
I don't know if that's true.
Look at London today. There was just those four people who died didn't think they were going to.
You know, certainly the little things of day-to-day life can be these little crosses that we we take up, but and are called to take up. But, you know, I think what we're looking at in Isaac and what we've been looking at in the fathers is, you know, that there is, we're called to die to self and to mm-hmm. sin, and we're called to engage, and, you know, anyone has this illusion that it can be, that battle can be won except with, you know, a bloody war against sin and evil, you know. It is an illusion to think that that could be the case, that we could live our Christianity out and, you know, feel that, okay, just by embracing the little irritations of life, that, you know, that we're living our life out, Christian life out in the fullness. Well, the gospel speaks of a lot more than that, and so does the cross. I think when we minimize the cross to that, we cheapen the suffering of Christ on the cross, but also what he's called us to participate in the sense of participating in the his redemptive work. And so I don't want to be, you know, sarcastic in my response to that or diminish that, but I think too often it has become, you know, this mantra of a mediocrity in regards to living out the faith, and, you know, an excuse to avoid embracing a kind of life that would really be reflective of the gospel and seeking the kind of holiness that God is calling us to. We may very well be called to this kind of martyrdom. And, you know, are our hearts really formed in such a way that we would be willing to die for Christ? And, you know, I think we are so immersed again in a culture that's, you know, that avoids suffering and escapes into virtual reality, that, you know, the moment when we would have to face any kind of persecution, we might buckle. And I don't think, you know, we can't be under, I mean, we buckle under simply the temptations of materialism and, you know, everything that we are presented with. You know, what makes us think that we were going to endure martyrdom when we can't endure giving up, you know, the things of the world that lead us into sin?
So would we say, faced with the reality of relative peace for now, like, if you know, we're not yet in a state of great physical danger, is it really our calling and our duty to seek out, to immerse ourselves so much in a life of penitence and prayer and that so deeply that we do seek out a white martyrdom?
We don't have to seek it out. The moment that you begin to engage in that life is the moment that you're going to be afflicted and that you're going to be attacked by temptations. And, you know, it's not like, you know, we have to go out. The moment that we turn to prayer and commit ourselves to it in a deeper way is the moment that we're going to be attacked. And so when we look at Isaac and the other saints, they would tell us that, you know, sort of the sign that we're on the way is because we're being afflicted. We're going through trials, you know, temptations are coming at us and trying to pull us away from prayer, and so we're constantly fighting that battle. You know, if we're not engaged in the faith at all, we'd probably be living a life of relative, you know, peace, mm-hmm. you know, in the sense, because, you know, why be, you know, the demons aren't going to worry about us at that point because we're wholly uninvolved.
Right.
So what better than to create this illusion of, you know, religiosity, you know, that is, you know, wholly, you know, sort of legalistic or, you know, issue-oriented, doctrinal, but in the sense that it's disconnected from the relationship with God, but also to the life of holiness that he's, and the life of grace that he's called us to. And, you know, our greatest illusions are our religious illusions and the illusion of being religious. And, you know, that's what we have to overcome. Okay, one little section more here. Moreover, from time to time, they appeared to them to teach them how they ought to lead their lives. Sometimes they clarified certain perplexities for them, or sometimes the saints themselves asked them for what was needed. And sometimes they guided them when they had strayed along the way, or sometimes they came to their rescue when they fell into temptations. Sometimes they snatched them from unexpected mishap and peril that overtook them, such as a snake or a ledge or a splinter of wood or a blow from a stone. Or sometimes when the enemy was openly waging war on the saints, they showed themselves visibly to their eyes and said that they were sent to their aid and brought them confidence, daring, and refreshment by their words. At other times they performed healings through them, or at times they cured the saints themselves when they fell into certain ailments. Sometimes when their bodies succumbed from lack of food, with a touch of the hand or with words, they fortified and strengthened them above nature. Or sometimes they brought them food, loaves of bread, which were oftentimes even hot, and other things for their nourishment. To some of them, they foretold their departure, and to others, the very manner of their departing. And so, to be fully engaged in the life of God and to move from grace to grace, to be drawn into contemplation, which is to be drawn into the very life of God, is then to experience the presence of all that is a part of the life of God, which would include angels and their protection for us and support and encouragement in the spiritual battle. Again, I'm glad that he emphasizes this so strongly and spends so much time, you know, precisely to rip it out of a kind of mythological view, as well as demons, that to be able to acknowledge the presence of that which is good, you know, is also to be able to acknowledge and see the presence of that which is evil. And so they are also often able to see, as with bodily eyes, the presence of demons acting on them or on their fellow monks. And we often will do the same thing with demons, you know, that these are just, you know, the mythical characters of movies meant to frighten us, but they have no power or no presence in the spiritual life. And those who start engaging in the spiritual life, you know, deeply will very quickly see, no, these aren't, you know, fictions of the imagination, but realities. Okay. Any final comments before we close for the night, or questions? Okay, we'll stop there and we'll pick up next week. And when we close, as always, with the Our Father. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
May God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Go in peace. Thanks be to God. Thank you all.